Hey, welcome to night school. Welcome. I got a message this morning. The first thing I saw this morning, actually, after I woke up, was a message from somebody who I haven't spoken to in quite some time, saying she had listened to the podcast and she asked me if I was on drugs. And the answer is no, I'm not on any drugs. Caffeine. Oftentimes I'm on a lot of caffeine. Usually those are the episodes with a lot more stammering, a lot more uhs. And you knows, a lot more disconnected flow. But yeah, caffeine's a drug. That's the only drug I'm on. And speaking of drugs, I wanted to riff off an idea from the last episode a little bit more. And that was the idea that weed bonds to its host. And in that sense, you know, weed doesn't make you peaceful. It doesn't make you anything necessarily. I mean, there are obviously certain universal experiences, certain universal sensations that marijuana influences. You know, it's the influence it has on people. There's obviously a reason why it is this drug that is known for certain qualities. But it's also, you know, there's also this chemical sort of reaction where when it's combined with certain people, based on that person's chemistry, what's going on in that person's mind, who that person is, it reacts to that. And in that way, you know, somebody who, you know, say is a psychopath will smoke weed, and it's not going to stop them from being a psychopath. In fact, it's probably going to contribute to some sort of bizarre pathological behavior. But music is the same way. And there's a reason why there's a sort of reefer madness about music, or at least there used to be. Because let me say, too, it's like I don't think reefer madness is wrong. I don't think it's completely right, obviously. I think marijuana is great. It's one of the few substances I actually want to use again. If I use substances again in the future, I'm sure marijuana will be maybe the only one, or at least at the top of the list. That said, reefer madness isn't completely wrong. It is talking about a certain experience that some people have with marijuana. It does make certain people who are crazy even more crazy. And music is the same thing. And the hysteria that you see, I think the best example I could use is after a mass shooting. And I don't really see this anymore with mass shootings, but what you used to see with Columbine and that era of mass shootings was the music they listened to. KMFDM. I don't remember what else those guys listened to. And let me just make a side note. What's really strange about just the way things have gone is I don't know the names of any of these mass shooters in the last 15 years. I don't really know the names of any of them except for Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. I don't remember any of them except for them. There was something just so jarring and memorable about Columbine. I don't know if the shootings since then have been less interesting or if it's just the fact that we've had so many, but they're not very compelling. And it's in contrast to serial killers, where each serial killer is typically interesting in their own way. Whereas I don't feel the same way about mass shootings. I think it's because serial killers are, it's this drawn out, highly, you know, there's just some sort of, the mystery of it, I guess, is a part of it. Each person has their own weird, mysterious approach to serial killing that makes them interesting. Horrible, but interesting. With mass shootings, I don't feel it's the same thing. It always comes from this hot-blooded, angry place. And I don't know why I'm even going into it. This episode isn't supposed to be about mass shootings. It's about music. And the connection to mass shootings is that when those happened in the past, people would say, oh, it's the music they listen to. And it's really funny, the idea of somebody attacking, say, KMFDM because Eric Harris wore their T-shirt. I can't remember the other bands that those guys liked. I remember that one because it was like the only time you've ever heard of that band mentioned on such a large platform. But, you know, I remember it happening, you know, with Slayer, obviously. Bands are often blamed for the actions of certain individuals. And people, especially in the 80s, protested satanic metal. And usually not like underground bands. They would usually attack, you know, the most visible bands because those are the ones that are most widely available. And I've always said, you know, a real psycho is going to listen to Pantera before he listens to, you know, Morbid Angel or something even more obscure. You know, a psycho is way more likely to be a Metallica fan than a Burzum fan even. But people did have this tendency to try to demonize that music and say that that music had a negative influence on youth. You know, Judas Priest was responsible for one kid's suicide. Ozzy was responsible for a suicide. There were examples like that. And kind of like with the Reefer Madness thing, I think there's a truth to that. And that kind of goes against everything you'd think I would stand for. Because it's like, oh, you know, you're saying that music makes people do evil things, or video games. That was the other one that came out of mass shootings, where it's, you know, playing these video games. He played Doom all the time. He sits around killing demons in Doom, and it made him shoot his classmates. It made him shoot the school up. And my attitude toward music and video games is kind of the same, where I don't think that it causes people to do that, but like with weed or any other drug, it bonds to its host. And someone who is developing some sort of violent fantasy, someone who is just, their life is just, you know, eating away at them, school is eating away at them, they have some other issues that haven't been properly dealt with, who they were, the way they were born, combined with, you know, the way they're treated. Who knows? I'm not going to try to determine why people have violent fantasies and want to hurt the people around them, hurt their classmates, hurt strangers. You know, those are deeper questions that I don't feel like getting into. But I will say that something like music can bond to that person. It can influence that person. I mean, think about working out. A lot of people listen to music that will pump them up when they're lifting weights. And if you told those people, oh, you're going to have to work out, you're going to have to go for a run, for an hour in complete silence, it would be torture to a lot of people. They want to listen to the Rocky theme. They want to listen to Beyonce, whatever they listen to. I don't know what people listen to that pumps them up. Some people, it's metal, heavy metal. But if you told someone they couldn't listen to that, they'd be like, damn, it's because music bonds to its host. It gives them, you know, this extra fuel, this adrenaline, and it makes it easier to do something that they would be more, it makes it easier to do something that they would struggle to do otherwise. I mean, I know when I'm working out, I prefer to listen to something. I go, if I'm going on a run out in the world, I'm far too paranoid to wear headphones, so I don't listen to anything if I'm on a trail. But if I'm at home, if I'm running the stairs at my house or lifting weights, I have to be listening to something. Even though there's a certain, there's something pleasant about not listening to stuff and like kind of getting into that meditational mode, it's still, you know, it's better to listen to something. And, you know, you do get something from that. You do get these little jolts. I know that when I've been struggling, if I've had a day where I just really don't want to do something, if I listen to a certain song or just listen to something that's inspiring, it could be a lecture, it could be a podcast, I get a spike in adrenaline, I get some kind of motivation. And I think that with people who have violent fantasies, you know, when they have something that indulges that, that I don't know if it gives them an adrenaline spike, I don't know if it's just a personal soundtrack or just something to engage with, I think that does influence them. I think that it bonds to its host once again. And in saying that, you know, people have this tendency to, if someone were to hear me say that, I think someone would be like, oh, well, you're saying that we need to ban those things. Because that's typically where it's coming from when you hear people say that. When you hear people say that music influenced a mass shooter, or that, you know, weed influenced some schizophrenic to kill his family, it's, there's this idea that, oh, because of that, we need to ban it. We need to ban video games, ban Quake, ban Marilyn Manson, ban weed. We need to ban those things because some people can't handle them, or some people were in some way influenced to do something horrible as a result of their interaction with those things. And the unfortunate thing about this whole discussion is I don't feel that way at all. I'm very opposed to that. I couldn't be more opposed to it. I couldn't be more opposed to the idea of banning most things, especially those things, considering those are things that I like. You know, the idea of banning any music, especially music that's subversive, goes against everything. I mean, I'd have to get rid of everything, half my interests. So I'm not saying that we should ban anything or hold those things, you know, accountable in any way, but I think we should acknowledge that they do influence people. And that's a tricky discussion because people, when they hear that, when you acknowledge that something has an influence, we have this tendency to think something needs to be done. Oh, someone couldn't handle that. Well, something needs to be done. Prohibition. Some people can't handle alcohol. Prohibition. Let's just ban it all. And it doesn't work. And it's interesting, though, now, you know, while I'm thinking about this, this idea of, you know, people being influenced by it and how there used to be this big push, especially from the radical right, you know, the fundamentalist Christian right was very into the idea of banning music, not just parental advisory stickers. Let's ban it. Walmart can't sell it. Our kids can't have access to this these forms of media. And I don't see that discussion as much now. And I think one of the reasons is because with digital media being everything, kids aren't buying CDs, for example. It's just there. There are so many different ways that you can hear things and listen to them. And your parent can't go through your CD collection. They can't go through your tape collection and find that Judas Priest CD that's just waiting there, ready to make you kill yourself. Parents can't do that, and there are so many different ways that kids can have access to those things now that are really untraceable. Even if a parent, I've never had any experience with these parental controls on the internet or phones, so I don't really know how those work, but kids, they find a way. Kids will find a way. In the same way that a kid could dub his friend's Judas Priest tape and write Striper on it. You know, he could write anything he wants on it and listen to it when his parents aren't home. I mean, you could do that with porn tapes. You know, your friend gives you the best of Jenna Jameson on a blank VHS and you label it WWF SummerSlam. You know, the kids will find a way. It's not very complex. It's not very difficult to hide things. And especially now. So like I said, you know, with I don't know how parental controls work, but I'm sure it's really fucking easy to pull up a YouTube song, you know, because all music is basically available on YouTube, which I never expected. You know, with downloading, with Napster, SoulSeek, all those programs, you know, I knew that music would just be widely available from now on. The second that that happened, the second that you know, file sharing became a thing, I knew music would be available. And then when YouTube came out, it's like, oh, a lot of old videos are showing up. I didn't expect all music to be uploaded to YouTube with and without the creator's approval, you know, because there's so many obscure things are on there, so many things. But kids have access to all that now. I mean, a kid can watch a kid can pretty much, you know, experience like the deepest underground of black metal, of death metal, of any obscure genre, just in a day. They could just spend 10 hours and have listened to like all of the foundations of a genre of music just through YouTube. And that's not including things like iTunes. I don't know what's available on there. I've never actually used it. I imagine a lot is available there, but kids have all these different ways they can access music. So the whole idea of banning CDs or, you know, banning certain artists from performing is sort of out the window, at least when it comes to parents. And what's strange is we've come full circle, and this is a discussion that I see happen all over the place, at least where I pay attention, and that's the idea of free speech. And now we're seeing, in the same way that the far left are the people who are the most afraid of the Russians now, they're also the people who are trying to stop artists from performing. We see that with Antifa ban, like trying to block metal artists with controversial content from performing, things along those lines, trying to stop comedians from performing, speakers. And it's sort of funny to me that things have come full circle where it was the fundamentalist Christian right who were trying to stop certain artists from performing or being allowed to have an audience. And they were also the ones who were, you know, terrified of the Russians, terrified of the communist Soviet Union having an influence. And now things have come, I guess not full circle, but they've done a 180. Not full circle at all, but they've done a 180, and now it's the other political group, the other side of the fence, who is afraid of the exact same things. So that's kind of funny, but I hear that discussion a lot, and I think it's an important discussion, but it's not one I need to go into right now. I'm talking about things bonding to hosts here. And along those lines, I was thinking about meditation today. I go through phases. I mean, I have continually meditated since I started doing it. I think I've only missed maybe 2 or 3 days total since I started doing it about, it's been about 8 months. I think I've been doing it for about 8 months now. More than that. I think I've been doing it for 10 months. It doesn't matter. But anyway, I've been consistently meditating now. And I was thinking earlier today how I had this aversion to the idea of meditation when I was younger. And what made me think about this was the idea of things bonding to their host. And I think one of the reasons why I was reluctant to try meditating, first of all, I had no reason to. When I was younger, the things I associated meditation with were just so far out of my ballpark. It just didn't make any sense to even try going there. But I had a title that I used for a musical project, and it was Meditative Consequence. And I didn't really think that through that much when I came up with it. It just kind of came to me. Meditative Consequence, it sounded cool. But the idea behind it, the idea behind that phrase, that title, was the potential, I don't want to say downside, but the potential aftermath of meditating when you're not in a good place. The idea of spending, you know, too much time just inward with your own thoughts, especially if those thoughts are negative. And I'm glad I started meditating when I did, because I feel like I had to do certain work in my life. I feel like I had to work certain things out before it would really work for me, before it would really have the sort of impact that it needed to have. And who knows, maybe if I started doing it earlier, it would have helped me. But I felt like I had to sort of untie some knots before I was able to start meditating, and in meditating, loosen those knots even more. I don't know, though. Who knows? Maybe if I'd started meditating earlier, it would have had an immediate benefit then, too. But I know that I had an aversion to it, partly because I thought, you know, what's going to happen if I just sit there with my eyes closed and dwell on certain thoughts? You know, what's going to happen? And it's kind of like that idea of something bonding with its host. And if I was in a negative place and tried meditating, would that take me to a deeper and darker place? If I was feeling depressed or angry, would I become more depressed and angry if I just sat there with my thoughts? And I might have. You know, I don't know if other people do that. I think that's sort of what rumination is. You know, when you ruminate on things, when you dwell on things that are unproductive, I think that is essentially a form of meditation. But I don't know. But that's a whole other topic, too, is I used to think that I meditated in my own way. I've always gone on a lot of long walks and done certain activities that either shut my brain off or cause my brain to go into overdrive. And currently, meditation does both of those things for me, depending on kind of how I'm feeling or what I want, really. I can kind of allow it to do either one of those. Sometimes I'll sit there and I just do my best to just shut things down. And of course, I'm not shutting everything down. In shutting the active part of my brain down, obviously, I'm allowing something under that to become more active. But fortunately, it's something that's sort of beyond my grasp. I would say it's definitely beyond my grasp, actually, not just sort of. But it's much different than just walking. I mean, it's much different than just these things that are like, oh, that's kind of like meditation. You know, going on a long walk, it's my form of meditation. Or you know, going running, doing this. There's a lot of activities we do that sort of, they're similar, but it's really not the same thing as sitting there with your eyes closed, or if your eyes are open, focusing on something singular. It's really not the same thing at all. Not to say it's not important, not to say it's not beneficial to have your own alternate forms of meditation, but I thought that I was essentially doing the same thing, and it turns out I really wasn't. But I'm glad that I started doing it at a time when I feel like I could actually get something neutral to positive out of it, and not just dwell on things that I didn't need to dwell on that would just send me further down a dark path. But there is always that concern, you know, if you're not wired correctly, if you're not doing well, that a certain activity that would otherwise cause you no issues would bond to you in some horrible way. I mean, so many things do that. I've talked about drugs and music with that in mind, but it's so many things do that. Just the way that we interact with people. We bond to people and people bond to us. And it's, you know, based on, and there's a chemical reaction to that. You know, the last episode, I feel like, dealt with that. The idea of things, you know, your relationships bond to you and are influenced by where you are at. And if you're a negative person, if you were in a destructive place, the result is going to be destructive. That bond is going to be a destructive bond. But while I'm talking about meditation, and, you know, it's something that I've been doing for a little bit now, and of course, when I first started doing it, I wanted to just recommend it to everybody. When I had my initial breakthroughs, which were important, because when I first started doing it, when I first tried meditating, it was, of course, a massive struggle. I was sitting there, and my brain was just racing. It was difficult to sit there and hold still. Every part of the process was a struggle. And then I had some breakthroughs. And once those breakthroughs happened, they allowed me to stick with it. Because I don't know that I would have stuck with it otherwise. If it had continued to be the same struggle that I experienced the first couple times that I tried meditating, I don't know that I would have been able to stick with it. And I think that's true for just about anything you try doing. Because most things are difficult to do, either mentally or physically, when you start doing them. And eventually, though, you'll have a breakthrough. It could be something like playing guitar. You're playing guitar and, you know, your fingers are just sore and you're not able to form chords. You know, you can barely pick. It sounds terrible. And then you'll just ring out a chord pretty early on. You'll ring out a chord and it'll just sound good to you. And that makes you want to keep doing it. Whereas if it just sounded like shit all the time and you never had a breakthrough, you wouldn't want to keep doing it. It's the same thing for running. If you start running and you're just horribly sore and you can barely move, it takes you 2 weeks to run again. You know, you wouldn't want to do it if that was your experience every time you ran. But you'll eventually have a moment where you feel this grace. Your body seems to be moving together, and you almost feel like a human land speeder, like your feet are barely touching the ground, and that's the sort of breakthrough you have. And that's what I had with meditation, where I sort of was able to let go of everything, and I felt like this glow. And it's hard to really, there's no way to verbalize it, because it taps into something that I don't think we have words for. It's, you know, whether it's your subconscious, whether it's your unconscious, whether it's some sort of imaginative state. And I think all those things are the same thing. Or they at least, I'm not going to say they're the same thing. I'm not going to say I actually know anything about all of this. But just based on how I see it, how I experience these things, I think those things are all tapping into something similar. There's crossover. I think that'd be a good way to put it. You know, because you think about the unconscious. And that's something we experience when we dream. But when you're meditating, you can reach a point where your brain does shut down and you're not experiencing present reality in the same way that you normally do. And it's almost like dreaming. And while I haven't had full-on interactive experiences like dreams, I have had glimpses, things that just kind of shoot into my brain, phrases, visuals, I will see scenes, scenarios, and when those glimpses come into my brain, I become aware of it quickly, and it snaps me out of it. And I'd imagine monks and people who spend hours and hours meditating, and a lot of their life is geared toward getting into that state, people who have been doing it for years and years, and who have other disciplines that reinforce that sort of mind, I imagine that they're able to sustain it more. Maybe they're able to trick themselves out of that awareness, because you become aware and then that snaps you back into present reality. So I had some breakthroughs like that early on, which kept me at it. And, it's strange though, because you can put this pressure on yourself. And for me, I do that a lot. I still do it. I try not to do it, but I do it. And after having those breakthroughs, I thought, well, I want to have those all the time. Every time I meditate, I want to have that experience. And then so you go into it overthinking the whole thing. You think, if I just do this, you know, it's like it's whenever you start trying too hard to do something, it usually doesn't pan out as well as it would if you just relaxed. One of the things I do is I've written down, if I have an idea come to my head that feels like it came from somewhere else, which has happened, I'll have phrases come to me, sometimes poignant, sometimes total nonsense. It's not always great material, you know, it's not always the best idea in the world or anything like that. I've had some ideas come to me, some thoughts, some phrases, because it's often phrases. It's not really a fully formed thought. It's sometimes a phrase or a fragment of a phrase. And it will come to me and I'll be like, wow, that felt like, you know, that's something I should write down. Other times something will come to me and I'm like, what is that? Why did that come into my brain of all things I could possibly imagine? And it's a lot like dreaming. It's a lot like dreaming in that way. And I'm going to get into that in a second here. But while I'm talking about meditation, I mentioned how there's the shutting down of your brain, and when you are able to relax and you're not trying too hard to shut down your brain, but you're just able to do it, usually it's like almost like you're able to focus while unfocusing. It's this weird, it's contradictory. It feels contradictory. It's too hard to verbalize, and explaining it makes it sound like it's a contradiction, but you're able to focus so intently that you're actually unfocusing, and you actually do feel this expansion. You feel this glow behind your eyes, this glow in your head, and it almost feels like you're focusing so hard but making no effort to do it. And in doing so, there's this expansion that happens, this kind of blurring. And that's what happens when you're able to kind of shut things down. And I don't like to say shut things down, because it feels like something else is being turned on, or something that was already on is coming to the surface when it's normally buried a little deeper. But the other side of that is sometimes my brain is in overdrive and I sit down and I think, you know, I'm just going to let all the thoughts come to me. Not the same frenzy of thoughts, you know, because sometimes your thoughts are almost like, well, I used the example in an older episode of, it's like Wikipedia tabs. When you're on Wikipedia and you get on this, you know, strain, you're on this, you know, this, I don't know, you're in that mode and you're just finding so many things you want to read about. And so you just keep clicking each little link. You'll be reading an article about something and it'll have a bunch of hyperlinked words and you're like, oh, I want to read about that now. I'm going to read about that next. And before you know it, you have 50 tabs open. Way too much to even read. And you know that if you go to any of those 50 tabs, those are going to lead to dozens more tabs being open. And your thoughts are very similar. And it was through meditation that I was really able to realize that. And I'm not going to say it's the most profound thought in the world. Oh, your brain, the way you think is like Wikipedia. You ever think about that? You know, I'm like a 14-year-old on mushrooms saying that. Your brain's like Wikipedia. But I did have that realization when I was meditating, because I was able to see each thought come to me. I let my brain just think, and each thought led to the next thought, and I could trace it back. It actually happened by tracing it back. I let my thoughts get ahead of me, and about five thoughts in, I was like, how did I get here? How did I get to this thought? And so I went to the thought that I had prior to that. And I was like, oh, that thought made me think of this because of this. That made me think of this kid who was in a class I had and something, you know, his mom said once. And that made me think of this thought. You know, I was able to trace it back. And by tracing it back, it was almost like tracing the hyperlinks in Wikipedia back. And it doesn't really feel like that when you're in your day-to-day life. It doesn't, you're not able to really isolate each thought individually. It almost feels like, just to keep using the computer talk, the computer analogies, I feel like your thoughts on a day-to-day basis, when you're in sort of a frenzy, when you're stressed, when you're anxious, it's almost like you're getting a ton of messages, like tons of text. Say like a friend is in a manic state and they're sending you so many text messages and you just can't even keep up. You can't even respond, let alone keep up. That's kind of what it's like. It's just this overflow and you can't trace it back and you just lose track and you almost just want to give up, but they keep coming. Or say you're on AOL Instant Messenger and you're just getting tons of different people are messaging you at once and the little windows are popping up and you can't respond to each one. And if you do, you can't really give it the time or energy it deserves. That's sort of what it feels like on a day-to-day basis if your thoughts overcome you. But in meditation, I was able to see, oh, each thought was sneaking. It was almost like a rat sneaking under a door. And I kind of feel the thought coming through, and it would just kind of sneak through, squeeze under that door, and then it was there, and I was able to focus on that thought, and then I let it kind of get away from me, and then, oh, a few more rats came in, but they were each coming in individually, so I was able to identify where they came from. And just to finish the Wikipedia thought, it's like Wikipedia. Your thoughts are like Wikipedia in the way that we think. It's very similar to that. But it's a personal Wikipedia. It's like a Wikipedia of everyone you've ever known and everything you've ever experienced, every idea that's been introduced to you, but nothing outside of that. Yeah, we do get new ideas, especially if you're a creative person or if you just try to think about things, if you're trying to solve problems. New ideas do come to you, but that's sort of a that happens in a certain setting. Or when you're trying to think a certain way. But for the most part, most of our thoughts are like a personal Wikipedia, and we end up with 50 tabs open. And one of those tabs might be something that happened 25 years ago in kindergarten, while the one right next to it might be something that happened at work today. It might be about the page of your ex-girlfriend might be right next to, you know, the page about your family trip to Disneyland in 1992. You know what I mean? It's very disorganized. And I think that's what people struggle with, is this feeling of mass disorganization in their thinking. And they want to dwell on certain tabs more than others. Let's let it go. I'm going to let that analogy go now. But I stand by that. I stand by the idea that we do think in a way that's very similar to browsing Wikipedia, where it's just like, oh, here's a link. Oh, this is interesting. Except when it comes to thought, you know, oftentimes we're just randomly clicking on things. It's not even something that we want to think about. And meditation helps with that. It helps you understand your thought process, and it helps you sort of limit your thoughts and get to that mode where you've sort of shut down the active brain and let whatever it is underneath do something. And sometimes that feels like nothing. And that's awesome. You know, when you're sitting there and you actually feel like nothing is going on, all you feel is that glow behind your eyes. And your subconscious isn't even doing anything. Your subconscious, whatever it is that's underneath, whatever's actively in your brain, whatever it is underneath, isn't actually putting anything there. And you just feel this wonderful neutral emptiness. It's not like feeling good. It's not ecstasy, but there is something ecstatic about it. Not ecstasy, but there's something ecstatic about it. So in that way, I wonder what it would have been like if I was in a really negative place, if I was deeply depressed after something horrible happened, or just if I was, when my wiring was much more crisscrossed and messed up. I do wonder what would have happened if I had tried meditating back then, if there would have been a consequence to it, if meditation would have bonded to me, its host, and actually had a more of a negative impact. I don't know. I'm curious if anybody has any stories about that. I wouldn't even know how to look it up, because most of the stories I hear about people who have started meditating are positive, or at least on the positive side of neutral. Because typically people who start doing that are looking for that. So I don't know. Maybe I don't need to look it up. Maybe I don't need to read about people who have ruined their lives through meditation. I don't know. But thinking about that idea of the something that's underneath, that subconscious, unconscious, that imagination, whatever it is, it definitely, it's either the same thing or it crisscrosses or parallels what you experience when you're dreaming. And I haven't done any research on this. This is all just anecdotal. I'm sure that I've heard things here or there. For a while, I've been keeping a dream journal, and I sound so silly saying that. It's something I never thought I would say. I mean, you instantly sound like a 12-year-old girl if you say that you've been keeping a dream journal. But I don't mind that. I don't mind sounding like a 12-year-old girl right now. And I've been keeping the dream journal on and off because it makes your dreams much more vivid, for one. When I'm actively keeping the dream journal, I find that I experience a lot more while I'm dreaming. I'm aware of a lot more. And you do have to write it down pretty much as soon as you wake up. Otherwise, you'll lose a lot. And I've been keeping a very detailed account of what goes on in those dreams, as much as I can possibly remember, even if it takes a lot of time to write down. And interestingly, sometimes I will forget things, and when I'm meditating, I will remember certain parts of the dream. And that's just one more reason why I feel like those states of mind are connected, or why they are tapping into the same whatever it is, whatever that is. I feel like we have words for it, but like so many words, they are filler. They are just ways of trying, they're filler words for things that we can't possibly explain. And certain people have, you know, I mean, you have Freud, you have Jung, you know, those are two of the only people who I've actually read their analysis on dreams and found it interesting, because I don't care about symbolism in dreams, not yet at least. Maybe I will. In the same way that I never thought I would have a dream journal, maybe I will eventually care about the symbolism in dreams. But I don't actively read about that stuff. I'm not terribly interested in it. But I did want to start engaging in dreams a bit more. And a lot of times when I hear people talk about that, it's because they want to lucid dream more often. And I find lucid dreaming exhausting. I've only had a couple experiences that I remember, and one thing I won't do right now is I won't recount any of my dreams. I find that very boring when people are like, well, listen to what happened in my dream. Like, let me tell you about my dream last night. If it's someone you're very close to and you kind of have that sort of relationship with them, I think it's okay to tolerate. Or, you know, if you're genuinely interested in someone's dreams, you know, it's an okay conversation to have. But I know that 99.9% of the time when someone wants to tell me about their dreams, I feel like a hostage. I feel like a psychic hostage. For me, I didn't start keeping this dream journal to, you know, induce lucid dreaming, because like I said, my few experiences with that have actually been kind of exhausting. I've woken up feeling like I didn't actually sleep. And the dream journal has actually sort of forced that on me as well. And the reason I started keeping it was because I had read some stuff about active imagination. And I listened to something or read something about how you should draw things that you see in your dreams. And in rendering something in your day-to-day reality that you saw when you were unconscious, that was swimming around somewhere in your subconscious, I say those words like I actually know what they mean, or as if there's any difference between them. But in engaging that, it's a good exercise. It's a good exercise to sort of render or represent those things that you saw while dreaming in your reality after you experienced them. And so I did these little sketches with a brush pen on scraps of paper, and I really enjoyed doing it. I don't think I want to continue doing it, but I really enjoyed doing it, and I saved the little scraps. I did it for maybe 2 weeks, maybe a month. I don't remember the exact amount of time. But that led me to start writing down what was going on in my dreams, and I found instantly it made me remember a lot more. It made me remember a lot more of what happened. It made me a lot more aware in the dreams of what was happening. not necessarily aware of the fact that it was a dream. It didn't lead to any more lucid dreaming than I otherwise experienced, which is very little. But it did just make me more aware. It made me more aware. It improved my dream memory. There's a phrase for you. My dream memory. Keep a journal. It'll improve your dream memory. I got some dream journals for sale. So that was interesting, but I also found it exhausting. Just like lucid dreaming has been exhausting in my experience, I found keeping a dream journal and making myself more aware of what was going on while I was asleep was kind of exhausting. Because I don't have nightmares, but I do have mostly existential dreams. There's often a sort of existential tension or stress. And the other thing that the dream journal has made me much more aware of is the categories of my dreams. And I haven't gone back and read it. It's February 27th now, and I believe I started keeping the dream journal in September or October of 2018. So last fall, I started keeping it. And the plan was, after a period of time, I would read what I had written. And for whatever reason, I don't know. I didn't have a goal. I just decided to start doing this. But I haven't done that yet. I still haven't reread anything that I've put in there. And I believe I've forgotten a lot of it. A lot of it, virtually all of it, I wrote down right after waking up, because that's the only time that I'm really going to be able to remember what I dreamed. And so I've forgotten almost all of it. And I do plan to read it eventually. But even without reading it, it did make me much more aware of the categories of my dreams. And it's almost like the Wikipedia thing I was saying. It's like, oh, ex-girlfriend dream, band dream, so-and-so dream, a dad dream. Just different basic categories. Nothing that interesting, nothing that profound. I mean, profound maybe in the sense that we all live our lives, and we're all people who have our experiences and things we hang on to and things we let go of. You know, it's all that bullshit. But in general, just my dreams are pretty boring. There's just often this sort of existential tension. And I've been known to have night terrors, too, where I kind of shriek or let out these high-pitched, I don't know what to call them, I was going to say murmurs, but just these pathetic noises, these truly pathetic noises. And I don't know if that's going on anymore. I'm only really aware of it when I have a girlfriend and they usually have to shake me awake. And those dreams are, the night terrors aren't in those personal categories. It's not like it's a girlfriend dream. I'm shrieking in bed that night. No, it's those ones. One of them that I had was I woke up, because I often, when I'm having those night terrors, I will often continue to verbalize whatever was going on in the dream, even as I'm being shaken awake. One of them, I said to my girlfriend at the time, a horse was staring at me. And that sounds silly. I mean, it sounds funny, but I can imagine that. When she told me that the next day, when I woke you up out of your nightmare, out of your night terror, you said a horse was staring at you. And that shook me to the bone. Because while I didn't remember the dream itself, I can imagine being stared at by a horse in a dream. And that's fucking ominous. It's ominous, man. I said I wasn't going to talk about my dreams, and here I am. But dreams are powerful. You know, even though I haven't read into the symbolism of them, I haven't done much research on dreams. Beyond keeping a journal, I haven't tried to do much dream work. Dream works. I haven't written a movie script for DreamWorks yet. Even though I haven't done much of that, I have taken more of an interest in dreams. And part of that is because of certain experiences. And one of those was a dream revealed to me that two people were related. Oh, here he goes talking about his dreams again. It was revealed to me in a dream that these two people who live in the same town, I mean, that's one thing, but these two people, it was revealed to me in the dream that they were brother and sister. And these two people didn't run in the same circles. One of them, I knew of her. I knew of her. I had never actually met her. I just knew of her. And one of them was a friend of a friend who I see once in a blue moon. And I don't know that I was ever given any information that I could have possibly used to connect these two people. They never interacted. I never heard them referred to together. They don't particularly look alike. I mean, they have the same hair color, but I had no reason to suspect that these people were related or connected in any way. And I had a dream that they were brother and sister, and I found out afterward that they were. And neither of these people are important to me. The opposite, really. They're two people that I'm aware of really couldn't be any less important to me. And I don't say that as an insult to either of them. I just don't know them very well. And it was very strange that it was revealed to me in a dream that they are brother and sister. And if I did have any information that I could have possibly used to connect that, I wasn't aware of it. And so if there was some tiny bit of information that I took in once, I never thought of it with my active brain. And with that in mind, it's like my brain must have done some sort of advanced algebra to figure this out. My dream brain must have done some kind of advanced algebra with some subliminal information I took in. Either that, or it just pulled it out of nowhere, which is truly, I wouldn't even know how to think about that. You know, so I imagine maybe there was something, some subliminal information I took in one time, I don't know, and my brain was able to figure that out based on, you know, who knows. It was one of those math, I'm not very good at math, so I can only imagine what that algebraic equation would have looked like, but my brain was able to do it while I was sleeping for no clear purpose. At least not yet. Maybe I will need that information. Maybe, and this was years ago, and so maybe 10 years from now, my life will depend on that little seed of knowledge. Oh, the brother and sister. And you know, the broken world will be glued back together by that information. I don't know. But that's the funny thing about it. When you say something like that, when you say that, oh, in a dream, this, I learned something about reality in a dream that I had no way of knowing otherwise, and it turned out to be true. When you say that to people, especially self-professed skeptics, they'll be like, oh, well, you know, you're getting ahead of yourself there. It doesn't mean anything. It don't mean anything. And I would agree with that. I would agree that that information was probably meaningless. But I think the simple fact that it happened is what's important. It's not that that information itself was important, the simple phenomena of it, and I do consider it a phenomena, even if that can be explained at some point in the future, even if some scientist is doing just some incredible research on dreams and he's able to figure out how your brain does strange algebraic equations with people and is able to find out they're related, how you're able to do dream genealogy that turns out to be real in the flesh. If some scientist is able to figure that out, cool. Cool. But I'm not saying that there's anything important about what I learned. I'm not saying that the fact that that could happen in a dream is itself important. Well, that is. I think that's important, the fact that that can happen. But I'm not saying the information or that actual example is important. And that's how I feel about synchronicities as well. I know I've said this before. But it's been a little while, to be fair. It's been a little while since I've gone on a synchronicity rant. But here I am talking about meditation and dreams. How could I not bring synchronicity up? But it's the same thing for synchronicity. And when you tell somebody about a synchronicity, if they're a self-professed skeptic, if they have their skeptic hat on, they'll try to reject what you're saying outright. And synchronicity, it's a lot like dreams, where if you're telling somebody who you don't really have that relationship with, it's fucking boring. It's like, oh, here's this really amazing thing that happened to me, this coincidence that came straight from the universe, and let me break it down for you. You know, it's not very interesting to hear about someone else's experiences with strange phenomena. But when you do tell somebody about a synchronicity, even if they experience with you, that's the crazy thing, is I've had crazy synchronistic experiences with other people. Where they shut it down. And that need to shut people down over it seems to come from this place like, well, don't get ahead of yourself. Oh, you're getting a little bit big for your britches. It doesn't mean anything. You know, it tends to come from that place. It's like, oh, it doesn't mean anything. Don't start thinking it means anything. Don't start thinking God was talking to you. You know, people will kind of take that attitude about it. And I get that, because there are some people who are extremely out there who every little coincidence, every little synchronicity, they need to tell everybody. They need to blow it up. They think, I mean, there's people who are truly out of their mind who will experience synchronicities and think they're the second coming of Jesus because of what they experienced. And I get that some people do that, but for me, it's a lot like that dream example where it's simply a cool phenomena sometimes. And sometimes the most meaningless synchronicities, seemingly meaningless, I like that phrase, seemingly meaningless. Sometimes the most seemingly meaningless synchronicities, just like finding out two unimportant people in my life are related. Sometimes those sorts of seemingly meaningless experiences just kind of reveal to you that there's something going on. It's not that the information you're receiving is that important. It's just that there is something going on. There's some sort of process that's just beyond your comprehension, and you're being reminded that it's there. Whether it's a personal message for you, whether it's just something you just happened to glance, whether it's something that's happening completely separate from you, I don't know. It feels personal because often you feel like the conduit. It's things that you are experiencing as a person. It's things that you are seeing. It's things that are coming to you. So it's easy to personalize it, and it's easy to make a big deal out of it. And that's something that I struggle with. Less so now, but I know at earlier points in my life, I was the person who wanted to tell people. I wanted to call someone on the phone when some particularly striking synchronicity happened. And I've learned not to do that. But I've also learned it's okay to talk about it too. I think that if you are so righteous and you are so high strung about those experiences that you feel like you can't even mention them, I gotta hold on to the magic. I gotta keep the magic under wraps. You know, I feel like that's bad too. And to me, it's a lot like the trying to not think idea. And to get back to the dream journal, I also used that for meditation, and I do have a segue, not just let's talk about the dream journal again, because I was also using it to write down ideas that came to me during meditation. And before the dream journal, you know, this is like AD and BC, pre-DJ, post-DJ, before the time before the dream journal, when I would be meditating and a phrase would come to me or a glimpse into something that just kind of came out of nowhere, I would jot it down wherever I could. But after I started keeping the dream journal and I decided to start writing down things that would come to me during meditation in that dream journal, because, I mean, how can you not use your dream journal also as a meditation journal? How can you not do that, you know? It's got to have all the above. But I started writing down, things that would come to me during meditation, but I found that it just added that extra pressure to me, where every time I was meditating, I was like, oh, rubbing my hands together. I sure hope I have something to write down in the dream/meditation journal after this session. I sure hope I sit here long enough to have some real cool spiritual idea come to me. You know, I started to feel that way, put this added pressure on myself when I was meditating. Like, I sure hope something comes to me. Fortunately, that didn't happen with dreams because you were just falling asleep and letting go completely. But with meditation, it was like this added pressure to sit there and be like, I sure hope my brain shuts down so that weird subconscious ideas come to the forefront. And that's the best way to make sure those things don't come. Right, Rosie? She's talking about it too. She was just trying to meditate, but she was trying to force it and didn't have any profound breakthroughs, and now she's upset. Because that's how you feel. You get kind of upset at yourself, but you put that added pressure on yourself where you're like, oh, you know, I sure hope this thing happens, even though that thing is dependent on letting go. So then you're putting this extra effort into letting go when you should just be letting go. And it's a major dilemma, and it's something that you'll come across a lot in any kind of spiritual discipline. But it's the same thing for synchronicities where, you know, when you put this added pressure on them, like, I sure hope a synchronicity happens today, and you look for them. I mean, that's the worst when you feel yourself looking for them. But part of that is because when you're not experiencing them, it's easy to think that you're doing something wrong. Like, oh, I'm not living or thinking as purely as I should. I'm not in the moment. I'm not in the flow of things. And the fact that I'm not experiencing this strange phenomena is a sign that, you know, it just sucks. It's a sign that something sucks, that I'm not doing something right. It's easy to think that way. But I think the best way you can think about those things, whether it's, you know, the things that you visualize or that come to you during meditation, or even simply the ability to let go and just let that glow overpower you in meditation, whether it's that, whether it's synchronicities, even crazy biblical synchronicities coming to you at a really important time in your life, whether it's a dream revealing something important to you, I think it's good to look at those things as a reminder. They're reminding you that there is something, that there is a process, and I feel very presumptuous even calling it a process. I don't know what it is. I don't know what's being processed in saying it's a process. It's sort of like, I don't know, I feel like the kind of guy who's like, did you know the universe is expanding? I'm just this little old scientist on Earth, but I can tell you that the universe is expanding, which I agree with, but I still think it's very funny, that arrogance. The arrogance that I can tell you what's going on way out there. I can tell you what's going on the fringes of the universe from my little laboratory with my telescope. I feel that way even just calling this whole thing a process. I don't know what it is, but it does often feel like some form of communication, some form of reminder. But just being able to see it as simply that and not feeling the need to rush in and you know, make more out of it than you need to and tell everybody and, you know, I'm tapped in. Tell everybody, you know, I'm tapped into the universe. You know, it's like, you don't need to do that, but I think you also don't need to deprive yourself. You don't need to torture yourself over it, because it's easy to torture yourself in all of this too. You want to find this balance, and in trying to find a balance, you often teeter one way or another, and sometimes you'll feel yourself a little too far over on this side or a little too far over on that. But you don't want to be self-important, but you also don't want to torture yourself in an effort to be less important either. It's a difficult balance, and I think it's what a lot of human beings go through without even realizing it. I think these things don't just apply to all this quote-unquote woo-woo stuff. I don't think it's just New Age spirituality that this stuff applies to. It's not just the occult. It's not just people who are practicing a religion or a spiritual discipline. These are things that I think we all experience some way or another. In the same way that music bonds to us or drugs bond to us, I think these things bond to us and we have to find a balance for them. It's sort of like what I was saying about listening to music while you work out, where sometimes it can be great to listen to it while you listen to music while you work out and get yourself pumped up. But there's also something to listening to nothing. And being able to do both is important, or finding some kind of balance is important. Reefer madness is real. Music will make you shoot people. Just keep a dream journal. That's my parting advice. Keep a dream journal so that you feel exhausted every morning and you feel stressed about writing down your dreams. You feel crunched for time because you decided to commit to a dream journal and now you have to do it every day. things are good. Things are good. And you know, on this show, I feel like I have a tendency to rant, especially the last few episodes. I feel like the show has been a little more negative than usual. Maybe it's the winter, not the winter blues, the winter, I don't know, the winter cold. All this cold weather is making me rant. I think the important thing that I should say about all that is it's easy to know where your boundaries are, and you find where your boundaries are through negative experiences. It's like much easier to learn from people's bad examples oftentimes than it is their good examples. Because when you hear someone who's successful or happy talk about why they're successful or happy, it sounds like fluff. It's like listening to a football player who just won a big game and he says, you know, oh, God's good and we worked hard. One of my favorite players, Russell Wilson of the Seahawks, you know, if you listen to him after a game, it's just, it sounds so empty. People call him a robot. You know, he just says, God is good. You know, oh, I just have to thank God. You know, all my teammates, we worked hard. Go Hawks. But I think he's telling the truth. It's just that it's hard to follow examples like that. It's hard to be like, well, what does that even mean? It's a lot easier to see somebody who's fucked up or something that's really negative or destructive and just be like, well, I know I don't want to do that. I might not be able to follow the advice of someone who just, you know, gives me some kind of fluffy answer for why they're good at what they do or why they've had success, why they're happy. But I can look at that person who's just a mess and be like, well, I can see certain things they've done and are doing, and I know not to do those. And in that, there's a balance. In that, there's a balance, too.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave, this golden land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me.